three different cannabis bills related to Prop 64 have been working their way through the California legislature. One has now stalled. On Insight, Cap Radio's new state government reporter Scott Rodd will join me for this week's Capital Chat. Then, poetry from a few tough old broads. That's the name they've chosen for themselves. Their latest poetry collection is titled Tough Enough. It has been published, and they will read at an ESAC Baby Boomers event Sunday at Harlow's. We'll hear some of their poetry today. If live classical music is your thing, Jeff Hudson has a few concerts to recommend. They're happening over the next few weeks, starting with the Reno Philharmonic and the Stockton Symphony, each performing shows this weekend. That's all coming up. I'm Beth Ruyak. Insight is just ahead. First, the news. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, we are winding up the week with more conversation to build the community. This is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Prop 64 was approved by California voters in 2016. It legalized recreational marijuana, and it allowed for the clearance or the reduction of cannabis convictions. But putting Prop 64 into practice has taken time. The California Department of Justice is reviewing the statewide records to identify convictions that might be eligible for adjustment. And a number of questions related to the recreational aspect of marijuana continue to confront lawmakers. And that's the focus of this week's Capital Chat. In the studio with me is state government reporter Scott Rodd. Hi, Scott. Welcome to Insight.
Morning. Thanks.
Glad to have you here. How much focus and attention is cannabis legislation getting right now at the Capitol?
You know, it's getting a good amount of focus. As you said, Proposition 64, the voters approved it, but there is still a lot to work out, even though recreational marijuana is now fully legalized. There are a lot of things that lawmakers are still trying to sort out. You know, when you bring an industry that was once black market and then gray market into the fully regulated economy, there are always going to be problems to solve. And so right now, that's what you're seeing in the Capitol. A number of bills have been introduced this year, and they're trying to sort out some of those kinks that have come up along the way.
We haven't spent time talking on the current legislation here on Insight, so catch us up on the latest in terms of what's being talked about and where are those bills right now?
Sure. So as I mentioned, there are a number of bills, but I'll focus on just two of them, ones that jumped out and that have a connection of sorts. One bill, AB 1530, would have allowed counties and cities to control whether or not there could be delivery of cannabis into their county or city from outside jurisdictions. And so there was a rule that went into place in January that would allow for statewide delivery of cannabis. So anywhere in the state, for example, if you ran a shop in Sacramento, you could deliver out to Yolo or up to Roseville. This was a clarification of a outstanding question that a number of people in the cannabis industry had as to where delivery could happen. But this left a number of cities and counties fairly frustrated, especially the ones that either did not want cannabis business activity in their city or county, or ones that wanted to have greater oversight of it. And so I actually went out to Sonora to speak with a city councilman who was uncomfortable with this rule that came into place, Mark Plummer of Sonora, and I think we have tape of him.
This is something our community really did not want. Proposition 64 passed with the public clearly understanding that every local jurisdiction would be able to control how their local community dealt with it. And this completely destroys that confidence that we placed in Proposition 64.
So you can hear some of the frustration there that that he had about this issue. And AB 1530, again, that bill would have reverted control to cities and counties to determine whether or not they would allow delivery into their jurisdictions. However, that bill appears to have stalled. So that the future of that bill looks unclear. It didn't get out of committee, but it is up for reconsideration if they would like to revive the bill.
So Sonora is in this group of 24 cities that has filed suit.
And one county, I guess, is included in that. And so the lawsuit continues to move through the courts, even if the legislation is stalled right now.
That's right. So it looks like this that this battle, so to speak, will continue, just maybe not in the legislature, but certainly in the courts. So you're right, 24 cities and one county, including Sonora, they filed suit in recent weeks against the state to try to reverse this rule that allows for statewide delivery. And again, their argument is Proposition 64 had portions of it that specifically spoke to local control that would allow cities and counties to control business activity in their jurisdictions. And they feel that statewide delivery undermines that local control aspect.
I wonder how many people were like me the first time I saw a billboard that went up that said home delivery. I thought, oh, that had never occurred to me that it would be part of the Prop 64 industry that was created.
And, you know, it's turned out to be a pretty robust part of the industry. And partly it's because there are typically lower barriers to entry. To run a delivery operation, you have to meet a lot of requirements. But compared to, say, storefront retail or cultivation, the barriers to entry are fairly lower. And you also have to have a relatively small space, basically enough to have to store your product and then to have a bay where you load your product into a car. And that's about it. So there's typically a lower barrier to entry.
So I may be jumping out of bounds here, but do you also need a license or the same license for delivery that you do to run a store?
You definitely need a license. It is different than to run a store. And so
that's your point.
Yeah. And so it is a different license. And again, here in Sacramento, there are significantly greater delivery licenses that have been issued compared to storefront licenses. There are about 30 storefront retails in the city of Sacramento, and quite a number larger than that are delivery only.
Okay. Any more to say about the piece of legislation that would require the jurisdictions to issue cannabis retail licenses?
Right. So this piece of legislation, AB 1356, introduced by Assemblymember Ting, it would actually require localities, cities and counties that where a majority of voters approved Proposition 64, it would require them to actually issue business licenses for cannabis storefront retailers. And this is, again, getting down to the issue of local control. There has been some questions raised about this bill about, you know, does it conflict with that local control aspect of Proposition 64? But Assemblymember Ting argues, you know, a majority of voters approved Proposition 64 back in 2016. And right now, there are a number of what people have dubbed pot deserts across California. Between 70 to 80% of cities and counties do not allow recreational or medical marijuana storefronts. So obviously, that's quite a bit higher than that the number that approved, the percentage that approved Proposition 64. So this bill would require those cities and counties where a majority of voters approved Proposition 64 to issue retail licenses, and it would be based on the number of storefront liquor licenses. So for every 4 storefront liquor licenses that a city or county has, they would be required to issue 1 cannabis retail license.
So the sponsor of the bill is the United Domestic Workers Union. This is interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's an interesting partner in the bill. And we actually have audio from a recent committee hearing down at the Capitol where this bill passed its first committee hearing. We have audio from that.
My union, UDW, represents over 110,000 IHSS providers like myself who care for seniors and people with disabilities across the state. Many of our clients have found relief through the use of legal cannabis products. We are sponsoring this bill because we and our clients deserve access to cannabis if it ensures the highest quality of care.
And that was Florence Croson, I believe, with the United Domestic Workers. You can already hear there was a little bit of challenge or conversation that was jumping in there.
Exactly. Yeah, this is definitely a bill that's going to have some heated debate around it. But the way that the lawmaker is framing it is a matter of access. And that's why United Domestic Workers is the partner or the sponsor, rather, on this bill. They're arguing that there is a need for access to medical marijuana for patients who rely on it and who may not have many alternatives for their medical needs. So if you're in a county or city that doesn't allow storefront retail, or for that matter, delivery. But if you live in one of those cities or towns and you rely on medical marijuana, you may be out of luck. So that's kind of the angle that they're going with for this bill.
I'm talking with Cap Radio's new state government reporter, Scott Rodd. He previously worked for the Sacramento Business Journal. Now he has joined Ben Adler in our Capitol Bureau. So officially, welcome to the station, although you've been at the Capitol and turning out stories for a while. What's your first impression of working in the California legislature?
Well, California state government's a big piece of machinery, and it's something that if you take a hard look at it and you start to turn over stones, you realize that there are many more parts to it than you first probably realize. So the legislature obviously is a big part of it, but I'm also making sure to pay close attention to agencies and to regulatory bodies. I actually personally think that there could be more coverage of that just in general from papers and from outlets around the state. A lot of focus is on the Capitol, rightly so, because a lot of activity happens there. But the regulatory bodies and the agencies, they also they have a big sway over how government functions, and they have a lot of impact on people's lives and the regulatory decisions they make. So getting my arms around that has been, it's been a bit of a challenge, but you know, it's been a fun challenge.
There is a story about you personally that's going to follow you. It's personal and professional, I think, now through the rest of your career. And that was in that Stephon Clark protest and the arrest of 80-plus people on March 4th, you were among the journalists who was arrested. It was right before you joined Capitol Public Radio. But you and I talked about this off air. I wonder if you could share a few moments of that experience and give me an update on what's happened.
Sure. So, yes, I was one of several journalists who were detained or arrested that night, and was sort of swept up in the broader group of protesters who were arrested, as you said, 80 plus. I was zip tied. I was on that overpass above Highway 50 for a number of hours. Was brought over Cal Expo where they processed us. Was released around 2 a.m. and got a couple hours of sleep and went back to work the next day. There have been some updates since then. I actually just received a letter the other day confirming that the Sacramento District Attorney will not be pursuing charges from those arrests. Mm-hmm. I believe only one person will face charges. He or she may have been carrying what was considered to be a weapon at the protest, but everyone else, from what I've heard, the charges will not be pursued. But it's also opened up a pretty interesting conversation between folks in the local media world and the city, and specifically SAC PD.
Right.
And SAC PD has been pretty open about having conversations about their procedures and their approach to handling press during protests. We actually, we being local media, a group of us, met with SAC PD, and we had a pretty long, wide-ranging conversation about what is expected of police during protests in terms of interacting with the press and what's expected of the press. And there were a number of things that both sides agreed on, but there was still a number of things where there wasn't consensus. And I think to SAC PD's credit, they've shown a willingness to work with organizations like the Committee to Protect Journalists and several others to review their policies and procedures, to review how they approach handling press during protests and demonstrations. And those conversations appear to be ongoing.
Again, you're listening to the newest member of Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau team, and that is Scott Rodd joining Ben Adler in Capitol coverage. For this week's Capitol Chat, I'm going to take us back to the cannabis legislation that's working its way through the Capitol, and let's talk about convictions. San Francisco and Los Angeles recently announced plans to clear or reduce tens of thousands of cannabis-related convictions. Get to why cities and counties are doing this now. And there was also an update this week, an announcement by the district attorney in Sacramento County.
That's right. Sacramento County announced that they also plan to clear thousands of convictions, clear or reduce thousands of convictions for past cannabis-related offenses. And so this, again, goes back to Prop 64, as a lot of things do with the cannabis world today. It's rooted in Prop 64. And the proposition allowed for the clearance or reduction of cannabis convictions. But it turned out that the number of people who came forward to get these cannabis convictions cleared or reduced was far fewer than was originally expected. And state lawmakers and local county prosecutors found that part of the reason was because folks either didn't know that they had this option, or the process to get it cleared was very complex. You had to go petition the court. It could be a lengthy process, a confusing or complicated process. So in San Francisco, for example, it was fewer than 25 people that came forward.
Wow.
Very few people came forward to petition to get these convictions cleared. So the state decided that they were going to take a proactive approach. There was a law that was passed and signed last year that would require the Department of Justice to review its database of convictions and try to identify ones that would be eligible for clearance or reduction. And I believe the estimation was it would be around 220,000 convictions that they would identify. And the process from there would be to send those to county prosecutors for the local prosecutors to handle. And county prosecutors would have an opportunity to review them, and they could challenge certain clearances or reductions if they felt that the individual would pose a public safety risk. But what's interesting is that those convictions identified by the Department of Justice are due this summer to counties. But a number of counties and cities are taking a proactive approach. They're saying, "Okay, well, we're gonna see what we can do to identify these convictions and to start clearing or reducing them on our own."
In Sacramento County, for example, I'm looking at a report from Bob Moffitt earlier this week that the office wants to dismiss 1,919 convictions and reduce 3,384 felonies. If a felony is dismissed, the record will be sealed. If the sentence is reduced, it would still appear as a felony, but one that was reduced to a misdemeanor. So there's a lot of detail. And again, as we were talking about local control, what each county and how each county will handle and process this can be quite different from place to place.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, again, you're seeing some local counties take a proactive approach, saying, you know, we're going to start reviewing our roles and identifying those who we think are eligible for clearance. And it's interesting for Sacramento County, Sac County, pretty much all cannabis business activities are not allowed. In the city of Sacramento it is, but not in the county. However, you're seeing a willingness from the county to step forward and say, okay, but we want to still see what we can do to reverse some of the problems that were caused by the war on drugs. So you're seeing this. For me, I thought it was a very interesting move from the county. Not totally surprising, but yeah, it's an interesting move.
All right, Scott. Well, first Capital Chat on Insight, now in the books. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. And you can find more state government news at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. They call themselves the tough old broads, and they're poets, too. In fact, they're acclaimed poets, and they will be on stage at Harlow's Sunday afternoon in an East Sac Baby Boomers event that is also a fundraiser. We'll talk about those details in a moment, but the tough old broads have a new collection of work that's been published by Cold River Press. It's titled Tough Enough. Poems from the Tough Old Broads. Wow, I've said it about five times now. It's time for me to introduce them. Here they are. Victoria Dahlke is here, a poet, and as many of you know, longtime art critic for the Sacramento Bee. Victoria, so glad to have you here.
Well, thank you, Beth, for having me.
You look neither tough nor old.
Well, so. I don't feel very tough, but I am. I definitely am old.
Catherine Holvine is here, poet and founder of the Readers of Homer. I think you get credit for this group, don't you, Catherine?
I don't know, perhaps.
Well, how did it start, and why Tough Old Broads? Why was that the name you chose
well,
for
Well, it was Viola Weinberg's idea, actually, and she brought us all together because we were all also centered around Annie Menebroker, who was a dear friend of all of us. And Viola just had this idea. She is the toughest of the tough old
no
broads.
Kidding.
She has stage 4 renal cancer. She's had numerous surgeries, and she just keeps going. She actually climbed up a mountain in Scotland with her walker.
Wow.
Not that long ago. I mean, she's an inspiration to us all.
Viola, I think you're listening, so
oh,
we're all going to say hello to you.
Yes. Hi, Viola. Hi, Viola.
So, tough to me has a survivor spirit to it, if you use
yes.
the word in that way.
Yes.
Catherine, what does tough mean to you?
Well, we all have struggled quite a bit and continue to and anticipate doing more.
Mm-hmm.
Struggle.
Yeah, more struggling,
you know,
yes, I'm sure.
It's that we're all old.
Yeah.
You have daughters, your daughter Laura. How do younger women embrace that idea of tough old broad?
Why, that's kind of a hard question. I think we're a little bit of an inspiration, if I can put it that way.
Yes.
I do.
Yes.
And I hope that that's what happens on Sunday at the reading.
Yes.
That we, maybe we mm-hmm. can communicate some joy in aging mm-hmm. and in writing,
right.
in responding to the world as poets mm-hmm. and friends.
And friends,
you know,
yes.
That would be my think.
Catherine was a longtime professor with her husband at Sac State, and after retirement is when you created the Readers of Homer, which is a nonprofit. And tell me what work the Readers of Homer is still doing.
Yes, now it's even grown, and we call it, it has a new name, the International Readers of Homer.
Oh, well, that
we
says
just,
a lot.
A year ago, did a wonderful, if I say so myself, wonderful reading of Cousin Zuckuss's Odyssey, both in Greek and in English, in the Megaron in Athens. And it was wonderfully received. It was opened with a refugee from Afghanistan who initiated the reading. It was splendid.
Victoria has mm-hmm. authored 2 chapbooks, 29 poems, and In the Absence of Silver. And with your husband, artist Fred Dahlke, have participated in many interesting projects. Mm-hmm. I like how you find a place for your writing and poetry to cross over with his artwork as well.
Well, yes, and it also crosses over with my job as art critic for The Bee. It's been a really interesting job to have had because being married to an artist, I have a lot of sympathy for them. But also, you know, I've just learned a tremendous amount, and Fred has been very helpful. I mean, he knows art history backwards and forwards. So.
When did this group come together, and do you write together? What is your time together spent doing?
Well, as we said, Viola really brought us together.
Mm-hmm.
We all knew each other sort of individually.
Mm-hmm.
Fred and Victoria were the first people Hans and I met when we came to Sacramento. And I've just known Viola forever and Annie forever.
Yeah, it's
and,
true.
That's how.
And I should add that Annie passed in 2016.
Yes, she did.
We have a YouTube clip of a reading that all of you did that Annie is the first person to step up in the group.
Right.
And I think the room was packed at the Poetry Center.
Yeah, it was.
So the celebration of the four of you as poets and as individuals has been very warm and receiving in this
community.
Quite
incredible. And it made Annie very happy.
It did. It was such a wonderful.
She was overjoyed at that event.
And it wasn't all that long afterwards that she did go into a decline and passed.
And she'd be very, very happy to know that we're doing this.
Yes, she would.
So. Her name's on the cover. Her work is included in this book. What a celebration for her family and everyone who loves her. The title is Tough Enough. Mm-hmm. What is tough enough?
I think it not as toughness, but resilience. And persistence. You know, someone once asked me, you know, what I attributed my success to, and I said, well, I just don't give up on anything.
That's right.
And, you know, we put one foot in front of the other, but to just keep doing what you're doing, and it's been quite an adventure, so.
Try to love it as you go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. But we have had, you know, I had breast cancer. I'm a breast cancer survivor, and Catherine had
open heart
surgery not that long ago. So we've all had our struggles.
You have a great spirit of joy and happiness, and I know that's not just because we're all here together, because I see you in different places in the community, and I think that resilience is very uplifting to people around you. At this stage of life, how is life? How's the quality of life?
Challenging.
It is challenging, yes.
Truly.
It is, because...
Surprisingly challenging.
Yeah. I just find, you know, I have some pretty severe arthritis, and it's difficult for me to get around as much as I'd like to. But it's just, you know, we just keep going. I mean, you have to.
That's what we call tough, I guess.
Tough, I guess, yes.
I'm talking with Catherine Holvine and Victoria Dahlke, two of the four tough old broads, along with Viola Weinberg and Annie Menenbroker, who passed in 2016. Their new book is Tough Enough. You can see and hear them read their poetry at Harlow's on Sunday at 1 o'clock. Admission is free. That's in Sacramento, but you are encouraged to make a donation to the East Sac Baby Boomers to benefit the American Cancer Society's rideshare program. I'd like to hear some poetry. Would you share something from the book?
Oh, sure. A lot of the things that I've written stem from my work as an art critic. And one of my favorite poems that, it's here, I know, I'll get to it.
You're going to hear
it. Oh, it's called the Jade Suit. And it's based on a wonderful sarcophagus-type suit that the emperor of China, or well, not the emperor, but the prince, this prince of China had. And I saw it in Seattle. Okay, the Jade Suit. A soldier digging trenches on Lingshan Mountain breaks through crust and falls through a tunnel strewn with rubble into an underground palace muscled out centuries ago for the secret apartment of Prince Liu Sheng and the bedchamber of Lady Dao Wan. What the soldier touches turns to dust, silks thin as locust's wings, embroidered with scudding clouds, fill his nostrils, coat his throat. Yet the soldier thinks nothing of these fancies, nothing of Liu Sheng's mantle of terminal incorruptibility. 2,000 green squares sewn with gold thread, cool as a chrysalis. He thinks instead of green onions sending up shoots, his mother slicing medallions of bamboo, the color of mutton fat jade, his wife plopping a raspberry nipple into his daughter's mouth, opened like a pale purple orchid.
Victoria Dalkey, poet and art critic for the Sacramento Bee, one of the four tough old broads who will be reading more from the book Tough Enough this Sunday afternoon at Harlow's. What a convergence of worlds and images.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank
beautiful.
You.
Yeah. Catherine.
Pretty simple little poem called Dear Poem. Dear Poem, I thank you for your insouciance, your weird, unnerving aptitude to say the unprepared for. You're the best thing in my life, and though I walk right past you, and though I vacuum past you, you have my real respect. I know you don't believe this, scattered as you are in notebooks, abandoned among the bills. But you're what I think of when dreaming. You stand there without expression, patient, and never the same. You're indifferent if I feel trespassed, and you endure me if I'm scared. You are like the tree, the giant elm equivalent to my skyline, that I needed back then as a child to lean my forehead against, calmed by its cellular truth.
Oh. Poetry by Catherine Holvine, founder of the now international Readers of Homer. Well, there's the love right there. that just is.
That's
is
right.
Absolute.
I have to
love.
Say that poetry has saved my life more than once. So
that's true.
Yes, I mean it is something
true for me.
To turn to, and when things are bad and when things are good. So
it has. When I'm writing, if I write, I live better.
If you're writing, you live better.
When I'm thinking about poetry, I live better.
I do too, Catherine. Yes.
I think it's really true.
Yeah.
And I want to thank Dave Bowles, if I can squeeze this in, for publishing our book.
Of Cold River Press, Dave Bowles. Yes, he's been extraordinary, and the book is so beautiful.
Yeah.
How far back does the friendship go between the four of you?
Well, Catherine and I, as she said, met, I guess we were the first people you met or something.
Exactly.
My husband was studying with her husband, Hans Holvine, at Sacramento State in the art department. And we just became fast friends. And I was a student at Sac State. So Catherine was my first boss. She hired me to do some reading for one of her classes. And she was she was my first poetry teacher, really, mm-hmm. I think, you know. And so we just go way back. And then Viola, of course, I knew through kind of the midtown art scene back in the 60s through D.R. Wagner and others. And D.R. introduced me to Annie, and I was so impressed because she was a famous poet, and I was not.
A student of mine told me, there's someone you should meet, somebody you'll really like. Her name is Annie Minnebroker, that was way back. I don't remember the year, but it was long ago.
Yeah.
This coming together then has been about friendship, it's been about poetry, but there is something to be said for sisterhood that helps you endure the changes.
Absolutely.
Certainly, yes. We have been dear friends for so long, and we share things, and we egg each other on.
Yeah.
So what's the invitation then for people to come and hear you read on Sunday? I feel that if people join in with you, there's a sense of community. There's a celebration of life.
There seems to be.
Certainly the reading we did, the initial reading that we did at Verge Gallery was so almost overwhelming, the love that was coming back from the audience and the love that we were trying to give. I remember Annie, when she went up on stage, she was first, and she went up to the microphone and said, you can call me Annie. Oh. And that just broke the ice. Everybody was intent on us from that point.
I think if poetry is at all successful, it creates more love, in atmosphere of love around. I do believe that.
What are each of you working on right now? Catherine, what are you
I have a memoir that's scattered around. And I'm also writing about Homer. And I'm writing a book of poems called The Sweetness of Prepositions.
Oh, how interesting.
Great title.
I never thought of a preposition as being sweet, but
if anybody can make it so, they'll look at the person across
Catherine.
The table.
That's right.
Victoria, besides your daily...
Well, I have a chapbook manuscript circulating. It's called Chinoiserie, and it's a 35-page chapbook of newer poems. And I'm also working on a memoir of our life in the 60s when, in fact, it's 1968 and 1969 when my son was born, but my mother died in 68. But it's also about Sacramento Midtown at that time and, you know, friends that we had and crazy things we did. We had some old movie theater seats, wooden seats that we had found somewhere. That was our couch. And we had an old pedestal sink that my husband found, and he put that in the corner. He didn't hook it up. He just liked to look at it,
right.
You know? So, anyway,
an object of art.
It was a wonderful time in a lot of ways.
You have seen so much change happening right now in Sacramento.
Yes,
it must
amazing.
Feel like a new city. In some
it
ways.
It does. Yeah. It does.
Different city.
Yeah. True. When I was born here, and when I was little, I used to come out with my parents. We used to go for drives out by what is now Sac State. And then it was just fields of beautiful hop plants. Oh, and it was gorgeous. And that was, we were going out to the country. So,
those might have been Roostdahler hops growing out there, I think.
Oh, probably. Yeah. Well, it's just changed a tremendous... I mean, even in the last year or two, it's changed.
The days when there used to be Kirby vacuum cellar salesmen coming around, one came to my house and started crying about the land around Sac State.
Oh,
saying
yes.
It was such beautiful pear orchards.
Well, we
it
could
was.
Go story and story and story, but I'll let everybody know you're going to be at Harlow's Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock, the Tough Old Broads. Thank you so much for the lovely visit.
You. Thank you, Beth.
And this is Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. What's known as the standard music season, fall through spring, is wrapping up now, with many groups presenting their final concerts for the season. CAP Radio's arts and theater critic Jeff Hudson is joining me for this week's Sound Advice. It's been a busy season, too, Jeff.
It has been a busy season, and it's going to be busy for about the next 5-6 weeks, and then it's all over.
Let's start with the Reno Philharmonic. There are two concerts this weekend to put on the calendar.
Right, April 27th and April 28th, that's Saturday and Sunday, at the Pioneer Center. Laura Jackson, their conductor for about 10 years now.
Yeah.
And she's put together a very interesting program for this one. Opening up, there will be a little bit of music from the Richard Strauss opera Intermezzo, which was composed in Germany in the 20s. And then there's also a famous choral work, the Mozart Requiem. But for me, the most interesting part of this concert will be the world premiere of a new piece by Chinese-born composer Zhao Tian, titled Transcend. And it marks the 150th anniversary of the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad, which came through Reno over Donner Pass and then ended in Sacramento. This is a brand new piece, about 21 minutes long, and it was co-commissioned. Laura Jackson sort of was the lead commissioner on this, and then they got 12 other orchestras, so a total of 13 orchestras, including the Utah Philharmonic, the Sacramento Philharmonic, so that means you'll be hearing them play it at some point in the future. All of these orchestras are somewhere on or near the route of the Transcontinental Railway. So the composer spent about 12 months traveling the route and included a Donner Pass for one of the tunnels that was blasted by the Chinese workers.
You said this is a brand new work, so you haven't heard any of it either?
Nope.
Ah.
It's in three movements. I can tell you that much because I've read the program notes.
Okay.
The first movement evokes the expansive desert landscapes of Utah and Nevada. The second movement features folksy Chinese melodies, honoring the contributions of the Chinese laborers. If you've been to the Railroad Museum in West Sac, you've seen the picture of the Chinese workers hanging in their baskets off the granite cliffs.
It's actually a beautiful piece of artwork. Yeah. And to think about the music that goes with that time and that experience, I think is poetic.
And the final movement is titled D-O-N-E, and it's based on the rhythm of the letters D-O-N-E in Morse code, which they did a telegraph message when the construction was complete, and that was the message D-O-N-E.
It went down the line everywhere to let everyone know. All right, so that again is the Reno Philharmonic this weekend, Saturday, April 27th and the 28th. Also this weekend, the Stockton Symphony is in concert.
Right, that's Saturday at Atherton Auditorium on the San Joaquin Delta College campus. And the story here is that conductor Peter Jaffe is selecting music that honors each of Stockton's sister cities. And so they have sister cities in China, in Mexico, in Italy, Cambodia, Nigeria, Japan, and the Philippines. And so there are all these little short pieces that reflect the music of those countries, plus a few Stockton celebration pieces, you know, to honor the hometown. It's going to have the combined choruses of the Stockton Chorale, the San Joaquin Delta College Choir, and the University of Pacific Choir. So it's going to be a big concert. Before the concert, there will be performances by dance groups in the Mexican folklorico tradition, the Cambodian Khmer tradition, and Chinese-style dragon dancing.
With all those choices, I don't know how you chose which clip to play for us, but we are going to hear some music.
This is a piece by Arturo Marquez. He was a composer born in Mexico, and I believe he lives in Los Angeles now. And the title of the piece is Conga del Fuego Nuevo. And the orchestra that played that particular recording is the National Youth Orchestra of the USA. Maron Alsop was conducting it.
Oh.
And that's the orchestra that Roger Shaw, young violinist from Yolo County, is going to be performing in this summer as both the member of the violin section and as the first alternate pianist in case they need someone.
Yeah, he is so talented, and people in this area have watched him grow up with his music, and how wonderful that he will be back on stage again.
The Sacramento Choral Society and Orchestra are wrapping up their 18-19 season with a concert on Saturday, May the 4th at the Community Center Theater. And this is going to be featuring a West Coast premiere of a recent choral piece by a composer named Dan Forrest, premiered around 2017 and was performed several dozen times during the past year in cities around the world. The piece is titled Lux, The Dawn from On High. It has five movements. The texts are drawn from sources including everything from ancient liturgical chant to modern secular love poetry. And it was inspired by the composer's impressions of light streaming into the interior of cathedrals in France and Ireland.
Mm.
Let's hear a little bit of that. Thank you. And you can kind of hear the light streaming in through the big stained glass windows in that music, can't
you? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, I wanted it to play a little longer.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking with Jeff Hudson. He's previewing some of the late spring classical concerts in the region.
There are two different groups performing the Fauré Requiem in the next few weeks. The Modesto Symphony will be doing it on May the 10th and 11th. And In Concert Sierra with the Sierra Master Chorale and Orchestra will be doing it in Grass Valley on May the 19th and the 21st. Now, the Modesto performance is going to be conducted by David Lockington, who's been the conductor in Modesto since 2007. He's going to be wrapping up. They're starting a conductor search, and sometime in the next 3 years, they're expecting to name a new music director. Also on the program for the Modesto Symphony is going to be Igor Stravinsky's landmark ballet score, The Rite of Spring. And if you've never heard that in person, I really recommend that because it's just an absolute fireball of a piece. But for the Fauré Requiem is also being done by the Sierra Master Chorale and Orchestra. They have a new conductor, Allison Skinner, who lives in Davis, and she's going to be doing that requiem and other works up in the Sierra foothills. One of the vocal soloists is someone I believe you've met, Kevin Doherty, who was on Inside earlier this week.
Just happens to be down the hall here, in the classical studio.
But he is, of course, a trained singer in addition to a morning host on Capital Public Radio.
With a beautiful voice.
With a beautiful voice. Allison Skinner also has a second choir, by the way, which is the Davis Chorale. They are in their 40th anniversary season, and on Saturday, May the 11th, they're performing in the Brunel Theater at Davis High School with a bunch of shorter works. But let's get back to the Fauré Requiem and hear a little bit of the final movement, In Paradisium.
So again, the Modesto Symphony on May 10th and 11th, and then In Concert Sierra on May 19th and 21st.
Right. And I should mention that one of the soloists with the Modesto Symphony is going to be Sacramento's favorite soprano, Carrie Hennessy.
Right. We can't miss giving her a plug along
the
way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We mentioned Roger Shaw earlier, who people in Davis are familiar with. And now let's mention another familiar name, another young musician who's been on Insight.
Unghee Cho, he plays the cello. He's been a soloist with the Sacramento Philharmonic and with a number of groups. He's going to be appearing with the UC Davis Symphony as a soloist, the other one being violinist Stephanie Zizak. They're doing the Brahms Double Concerto with Christian Baldini conducting. It's especially interesting because Unghee never went to UC Davis, but they're having him as a soloist.
Yeah, I always think of him as a UC Davis student.
No,
he didn't study music there.
Unghee also has a project of his own, the Mellon Music Festival, which is a chamber music series. That'll be four intimate chamber music concerts at different locations in Davis on May the 24th, 25th, and 26th. So let's hear a little bit of the Dvorak Piano Quintet. That was a sample of a recording by a graduate student group, actually, from back east, Stony Brook University in New York State. And that's a piece that Unghee will be playing as part of the Mellon Music Festival with his compatriots, mostly from the New England Conservatory.
So that's in late May. He is a soloist with the UC Davis Symphony Orchestra earlier in the month on May 4th. Finally, let's talk about one more. This is a concert coming up in June.
June the 2nd, tail end of the season for the Mondavi Center. Alexander String Quartet will be performing with pianist Joyce Yang. They are going to be premiering a brand new piece by a young composer, Samuel Adams. His music's been done at the Mondavi Center several times by the San Francisco Symphony and others. He is the son of composer John Adams, who's written the operas and the big orchestra pieces. Sam is now 33. He lives in New York. He grew up in the Bay Area. He also sometimes vacations. There's a family cabin up near Truckee where he sometimes goes to compose. Brand new piece. Really looking forward to hearing it. Can't tell you what it's like because I missed the preview performance back in December where they sort of gave it a trial run.
Okay.
Also on the program, there are going to be some traditional works for piano and string quartet. There's a Mozart Piano Quartet No. 2, and there's the Brahms Quintet for Piano and Strings No. 2. There's a recording of the Alexander String Quartet and Joyce Yang playing that, so let's hear a little bit of the first movement of that. Pretty stirred up, isn't it?
That sounds like a big movie score.
Well, it's a symphonic type piece, but it's only five musicians on the stage.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. That is Jeff Hudson, and that's this week's Sound Advice. You can find more details about the concerts he talked about and links to the venues. It's all at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our senior producer is Helen Barrington. Our producers are Cody Drabble, Bert Johnson, and Kate Gonzalez. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today, Anthony Van Hook with Antonio Munoz. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.